Thank you very much indeed. And it is, of course, a great pleasure to be here, and needless to say, the announcement of the award of the Leontief Prize has put me in an exceptionally good spirit. It's an honor that I actually am especially happy to have received, because actually Vasily Leontief, after whom it was named, was my very first professor of economics. First class I took in the field was his on the structure of the economy of the United States. And he was also my father's closest friend in the Harvard Economics Department, which he taught in for very many years. And to give you just a flavor of the logic of his mind and his sense of humor, I have to tell you a little story about a moment, a very difficult moment in the history of the economics department at Harvard, when two radicals, Sam Bowles and Herbert Gentis, were up for tenure. There was a terrific battle over whether they would get it. My father and Leontief were in favor, and many of the others were opposed, and the battle was lost. And commiserating with each other one day, my father said to Vasily, "Vasily, if we were up for tenure in this department today, how many votes would we get?" And so they each sat down and they counted. My father came up with 8, and Vasily came up with 9. My father said, "Vasily, let me look at your list. How did you get 9 when I only got 8? He looked at Vasily's list and said, "Vasily, you can't vote for yourself for tenure." And Leontief replied, "Why not? I'm a tenured professor in this department." Any event, we are here at a rather trying moment, I think, in modern economic history, and in perhaps also a moment that at least should be trying in the history of economic thought. The great financial crisis came to a head almost 5 years ago. It actually was clearly developing just about 6 years ago. And it is a moment when it may be useful to think about these events in their larger historical perspective. We've had time since these events for there have developed a distinct aftermath, and that too deserves a word of analysis. 5 years is a very long time. It's longer than the United States, for example, was involved in World War II. It's longer than the Great Depression in the United States between the market crash of October of 1929 and the inauguration of Franklin Roosevelt in March of 1933. And yet, notwithstanding the gravity of these events, we haven't really, I think, come to grips with them. There is, underlying this, a long-standing, one might call, standard view. A view which holds that the economic growth, which most of the industrial world experienced almost continuously from the end of the Second World War until the turn of the millennium, is a phenomenon characterized by, let's say, historical normality. That being so, we have an ingrained habit of thought of considering the crisis as an interruption, as a transient set of events which will pass with time. It's temporary. And if one takes that general framework for considering this question, then one is easily drawn into the debates which have been swirling around us for quite some time about the causes of the crisis. A debate which is focused largely on what we might call proximate events. And I don't want to go into these in all of the litany of detail that have been offered, but I can give you a sequence of examples. There is actually a body of argument that holds that we should view the crisis in basically in statistical terms as an exceptionally bad draw, a random draw from a pool of possible events. This goes by the name of the Black Swan's view of the crisis. Simply a piece of extremely improbable bad luck that just happened to occur. And there is a variation of the same argument, or an argument in a similar style, which holds that the system that we operate on is prone to unlucky events with greater frequency than we imagined, and so we are continually surprised by them. That is a point of view which can be summarized in the phrase fat tails. A draw on a probability distribution which is more dangerous than we thought. And if you take either of those viewpoints, there really isn't much to be done except expect that there will be a return to the center of the distribution sooner or later, and that the economy will right itself. A similar, but slightly more structured perspective on these matters holds, advances what is not so much a explanation for the crisis as a physical metaphor intended to convey some of the flavor of the events that we have been living through. And that is the metaphor of the bubble. The bubble is a conceptual framework, if you like, that doesn't really give you any economic intuition or insight. It simply conveys the process of a slow expansion and a rapid collapse, right? Along with certain, perhaps, implications. Bubbles are rather innocent things. Nobody is really to blame. They're the kinds of things that intrigue children. And it's also a least reasonable inference from the use of the metaphor that the bubble does not represent anything fundamental in the economy. When it pops, things go back to the underlying equilibrium. Right? And to the extent that that metaphor controls thinking, one might be tempted to say, well, not much you can do. You can't even really know when you're in a bubble. After it bursts, you'll recognize it, and then you clean up the mess. That was something that in the United States before the crash was known as the Greenspan Doctrine. And then there are rather more critical perspectives which do hold that something avoidable went wrong. Right? And there are conservative versions of that point of view and, as we say, progressive or liberal versions of that point of view. One conservative version, aired extensively in the United States, holds that what went wrong was excessive government intervention in the housing markets. Right? That what had happened was that well-meaning liberals interfered with the pricing process in housing markets, encouraged people to take out loans and businesses, banks to grant them, which then fostered an unstable development in housing finance. That's the Republican position, the minority position, in the report of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission of a few years ago. And on the other side, something close to the majority position of the same report and articulated by a number of very good friends of mine, is the counter-argument that what went wrong was the desupervision of the financial sector and a massive wave of financial fraud. Essentially corrupt and even criminal activity, beginning with the issuing of mortgages that were known could never be paid, moving through the securitization of those mortgages and their sale to gullible investors all over the world, especially in Europe. So as I said, if you take the first two or three of these particular perspectives, you draw the implication that the crisis is transitory and that it will pass with time. If you take the second two, whether the conservative or the progressive variation, you can draw the inference that it could have been prevented, and also that there may be remedial steps which will enable it to be cured. All of these perspectives, it seems to me, share the same underlying vision of the unfolding of economic events from the end of the Second World War until just before the crisis, as a vision of economic growth explained or at least analyzed in part with the theoretical framework that was developed largely in Cambridge, Massachusetts, actually, in the 1950s under the rubric of the theory of economic growth. A version of which was also modified to be offered up to the rest of the world as development theory. A theory which held that with population growth and the increase of capital equipment and concomitant technological change, that it was possible to experience indefinite economic expansion and possible for the poorer countries of the world to catch up with the rich. There was a reason why this particular theory was propagated when it was. It was a, in part, response to the post-war optimism that was associated in America, in particular with the victory in the Second World War, the overcoming of the Depression, and the and especially the ongoing competition with the USSR, with the Soviet Union. It provided an ideological framework that could explain, and really for the first time, could put a mixed capitalism on a competitive framework with the Marxist, socialist, and communist utopia, in which a great many people in those years believed. Before the Second World War, I think it's fair to say no such vision existed. If you go back to the 19th century and read the work of Karl Marx, of course, he famously extols the Industrial Revolution led by the bourgeoisie, and which he studied intimately through the with the help of his good friend in Manchester, Friedrich Engels. That accomplishment, however, was, in his view, although revolutionary and epochal, it was violent and transient. It was not something that he expected to endure. And it was a puzzle for the late 19th century as to why it was that living standards were in fact rising. Why it was that the Malthusian trap that had informed Malthus, Ricardo, and certainly influenced Marx, had not closed on the industrializing world. John Maynard Keynes, as a young man, addressed this question in The Economic Consequences of the Peace, 1919. And what he says about it is quite interesting. He attributes the slipping of the bounds of Malthusian pessimism to especially the opening up of new terrains for agriculture, tropical oils, North American wheat, which he saw, I think, clearly and correctly, had relieved the raw constraint of calories on the process of population growth and expansion. Schumpeter, a little later, developed a view of capitalism as a engine of rising living standards, but a very turbulent one, which he also did not expect to survive. And of course, Keynes in his mature years in the 1930s and into the 1940s was dealing with the apparent collapse of the engines of saving, investment, and growth. Actually, the word growth isn't much used at that time. The problem of mass unemployment and indeed the threat to the survival of the system that was the Great Depression. The Great Depression was a deep threat to the survival of the system. March of 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt took office in Washington, there were machine gun nests on the rooftops of the federal buildings along the parade route, something had never been seen before. It was, even in the United States, an extremely dangerous moment, and of course a catastrophic one on the continent of Europe. Keynes was aware and argued that it need not always be so. He wrote an essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, but those possibilities were, at least at that time, still substantially theoretical. Post-war period changed all of that, and over a long moment, the notion that rising living standards, economic growth, was a permanent feature of our world became very much set in concrete in our minds. And today, it is part of a mechanical process of forecasting that goes on all over the world that consists of dividing the future into the actual track of total output, gross domestic product, and its potential track, which is calculated as a trend from past performance. And the success of economic policy is calibrated by the distance between the actual and the potential. There is also a theory, which has worked its way, I think, insidiously into forecasting models, which goes back to Milton Friedman in 1968, and is the theory of the natural rate of unemployment. The notion that there is a self-regulating mechanism in labor markets that will bring an economic system back to a state of high employment if nobody interferes with it. And there is, an agenda of labor market deregulation and flexibilization, which is hidden there. But even without that, in the United States, that notion that 5% is the normal and natural rate of unemployment, simply built into forecasting models over a 5-year time horizon. And so when there is a serious shock to the system, as there was in 2007, 2008, the forecasters get to work and they tell you that by 2013, everything will be fine. Right? And that is the way in which our expectations are formed. I think, though, that if we examine our memories, and quite a few people in this room are, you know, shall we say, eligible to have them, the historical picture that I've just drawn probably won't support the complacent interpretation that I've described economic theory as giving to it. I came of age, and Gary Dembski came of age in economics, just at the moment when this particular vision came to its first major problem, the early 1970s. The first 25 years of the post-war period were years that basically supported the insights of the 1950s, insofar as the whole world economy grew and grew together, with many of the poorer countries of the world just emerging from colonialism, growing at rates that were modestly higher than those of the rich, so there was actually convergence, kind of validating the optimistic vision. Now that's in the historical record, you can check it directly, but you can also measure the inequalities across the world in this time, and they are at worst stable, and at best, modestly being reduced, which is what tells you that the poor are growing more rapidly than the rich. And economic historians and development theorists talked about this at the time, why the poor speed up and why the rich slow down. Books like that sort of title. That phase came to an end in the 1970s. It came to an end, and some of the institutions that underpinned it, including the Bretton Woods exchange rate system, were dismantled. And a very unstable decade ensued, in which, in the first instance, actually the poor countries grew substantially more rapidly while the rich went into recession. This was the oil shocks and the commodity price booms, and recycling of petrodollars, which meant that some places, including Latin America, were able to grow quite rapidly, even though they were being pinched by rising resource costs. Now, that was a short interlude, as it turns out, although it was one that caused us in our graduate school days a great deal of perplexity over things like the falling rate of productivity growth and stagflation, the combination of inflation and unemployment. And then, as I suspect again some of you in this room will remember, in the early 1980s, the empire struck back. Okay. President Reagan, Prime Minister Thatcher, Chairman Paul Volcker of the Federal Reserve Board, took steps which we experienced as being quite brutal, quite abrupt, quite dramatic, as affecting large swaths of established industry in North America, here in the UK, and on the European continent. But what we experienced was nothing like what the rest of the world experienced. What the rest of the world experienced was an end to the processes of development. A massive reversal of the industrialization of the post-war period. That was what was experienced in Brazil. That was what was experienced in Argentina. A collapse of public institutions that provided health and education was experienced all through Africa. Collapse of the capacity to import because credit was cut off. Right? And if you look at the the world economy over this period, you find that while what we'll call the North, the industrialized, the developed countries of the West anyway, resumed growth, nobody else did. You had lost decades everywhere. And this is something which, you know, is a way of summarizing in a very compact fashion the results of work that I did over many years in attempting to measure the trajectory of economic inequality at the world scale. It became clear in the 1980s that inequality was rising, which it had not been doing before. And a whole series of ad hoc explanations began to be thrown around about this. This was due to globalization. It was due to technological change. It was due to a race between technology and education. All kinds of things were cooked up, all basically on the spur of the moment to explain it. And when you looked at the evidence, you found it was extremely thin, very unpersuasive, because there simply had not been enough measurement of what was actually going on around the world to enable one to develop a systematic picture. And the work that I did with my students at the University of Texas, and which is the basis for the Leontief Prize just announced, was basically aimed at filling in the record, of figuring out ways to use available data sources that we could afford too, which meant, you know, hundreds rather than thousands of dollars, and cups of coffee, graduate student time, to provide estimates and, we say, approximations for the movement of inequality around the world. And we turned out we could do this quite successfully. And what it showed is precisely that the turning point is in the early 1980s. That the turning point's actually, there's a one in 1971 when the Bretton Woods institutions are dismantled, and again in 1980. And from 1980 to 2000, inequality rises throughout the world, but in waves. In Latin America and Africa in the first part of the 1980s, incident to the debt crisis. In Central Europe and the former Soviet Union in the late 1980s, incident to the collapse of those regimes. And then in Asia, incident to the changes in China and to the liberalizations going on all over that region in the 1990s before the Asian crisis. And the peak in the rise of inequality coincides exactly with the peak of the credit boom associated with information technology, in the United States especially, in 2000. The two things are essentially part and parcel of the same global phenomenon. A massive concentration of incomes in a core economy that came very substantially at the expense of poorer people all around the world. And then it crashed. And I think one can identify the turning point not as 2007, but as 2000. That's a historical point I think I want to offer to you. And what happened between 2000 and 2007 was we had one of the most unfortunate saps as in the history of the United States as our president. the brother of my high school classmate, Jeb Bush. And I have to tell you that my sympathy for George W. Bush's administration is under extremely good control. But having said that, you gotta give the guy a little bit of credit for trying one damn thing after another. He came in after a long credit boom had ended, and what will appear, I think, to be the last business-driven credit boom that we're likely to see, for reasons I'll come to, at least in a long while. And the first thing he did was to throw a big tax cut at the problem. 2001, 2003. The second thing he did was to throw a medium-sized war at the problem, right, in 2003. And the medium-sized wars are just not what they used to be, you know. my father was closely involved in the mobilization for World War II controlled prices. They managed to double GDP in 4 years, 25% per year. George W. Bush, for the Iraq War, managed to get U.S. GDP up by 1.25% for a couple of quarters. At least in macro terms, it's just not what it used to be. And then, recognizing that that was not going to get him elected, I don't say re-elected because, you know what happened. He told the Congress to pass any appropriations they wanted, Republican president, Republican Congress, and this was an exercise in the opposite of fiscal responsibility, but they did, and that did the trick, and scraped through 2004. Now, that wasn't going to get him through his second term, so what did he rely upon? He relied upon the ongoing first deregulation under Clinton and then desupervision of the financial sector, which had been pushed aggressively under his administration by the people he appointed to supervise the banking sector and the thrift industry. 2001, they removed the fraud inspectors from the FBI, never replaced them. 2003, the head of the Office of Thrift Supervision showed up at a press conference with a chainsaw. This is not a subtle gesture. Right? This was to the business press. It was to convey the idea that underwriting standards were being relaxed with a chainsaw. Okay. And one can go through a litany of other ways in which they fostered and encouraged the most massive wave of unpayable mortgages in the history of the world, which are then, as I said before, securitized, given a laundering by Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch, and then fenced to the investment community in the rest of the world. And I've often quoted Michael Lewis's luminous book, The Big Short, and the little passage in which one banker says to another, "Who is buying this stuff anyway?" And the answer comes back in one word, Dusseldorf. That got him almost to the end of his term. Not quite. And the crash came. The crash came in August of 2007 because the banks realized that their counterparties were untrustworthy as they were themselves. The interbank lending market dried up. And you had a series of efforts to stabilize bankrupt investment banks, which failed ultimately with Lehman Brothers and AIG. In 2008. And then a massive rush to safety, to liquidity for those who were still had anything to protect. Right? a rush which lowered the yields on British gilts, German bunds, United States Treasury bonds and bills, raised them on the sovereigns, the weak sovereigns of the Eurozone. A single consequence of this global credit collapse. With the further development that time has gone by and the resilience built into our models and our expectations and our minds about the performance of our economies is nowhere to be seen. What we have is disappointment. We have forecasts that are that fail, and when they fail, they are repeated with a new time horizon. 6 months from now, growth will resume. Right? You can read this in the European Commission's documents and also in the forecasts of the Congressional Budget Office with depressing regularity. And people must surely recognize that their audiences for these things are getting a bit skeptical by now. But you have to sympathize with them. They can't think of anything else to do. Throw up their hands and say, no, there won't be a recovery? It's a problem. I'm glad I'm not a forecaster, and I'm glad they didn't exist when Franklin Roosevelt took office in 1933. Oh, everything will be fine by 1935 if you just do nothing. It becomes an absolute barrier to considering the case for a much larger action, and it becomes an excuse for those who say, well, we ought to look at the long run when the economy recovers and think about our fiscal position and cut back on pensions and health care now, with effect later, something which is happening in all of our countries. And in this kind of aftermath of stagnation at best and continued decline at worst, we've settled into a rather, I think, sterile debate between two positions, neither of which I like, although one of which I like less than the other. You might call them the Austerians and the Stimulards. The Austerians argue that recovery will come when government gets out of the way. And the Stimulards, or another phrase I like, is the false Keynesians, so I don't think Keynes would have taken this position in these conditions, argue that recovery will come when government gets into the act. And that's a nice, easy choice. You can simplify it down to the pages of The Economist. And as a dichotomy, it serves the purpose of providing, in a sense, the appearance of a real debate while obscuring the serious questions that we are not effectively facing. And what are those questions? What are the barriers to a return to the post-war growth track? I think there are basically four of them. First one is resource costs. Not the physical availability of, let's say, energy resources, which was the concern of the Club of Rome in early 1970s. But two things. The resource cost associated with extracting energy and other resources, practically everything else, food in particular, depends on the real cost of energy. But tar sands and deep offshore drilling are much more expensive than sticking pipes into the sands of West Texas or Saudi Arabia. And the second thing is the financialization of those markets, which may, in some ways, in the short term, be a more serious matter. Because what happens is that if you get a source of demand, an impetus of growth, it's very easy to run up the price of the energy resources required to fuel it and to siphon off the stimulus as a tax, effectively. A Ricardian rent. This mechanism was known in the 19th century. And I think it's behind the fact that oil prices went up to $148 in the summer of 2008. Quickly collapsed. And the problem with that is, first of all, it does tax away effective stimulus. And secondly, it creates an enormous amount of uncertainty as far as investors are concerned, business investors. People who are investing in new energy resources are worried that the price will collapse, and that's going to affect renewables in particular. They need a high price. And people who are investing in energy-using activities are worried the price will get out of hand and run them into the ground before they can make a decent profit. And the level of uncertainty in that respect seems to me to be a serious factor. Second thing I would mention, closely related actually, is the palpable failure failure of an enforceable military security in the world. Now, obvious, and I think the first Gulf War was intended to impress upon the world the capacity of the United States to establish a to do whatever it wanted. And the second Iraq War and the Afghan War have impressed upon the world the complete futility of that effort to exercise power. Simply, the reach of this particular technology has been demonstrated to be extremely limited. So there's another source of instability. And the third thing, which is very controversial these days, is the impact of all of the new digital technologies on labor. We were raised to believe that there were always going to be more jobs when a technology came in and disrupted things. And our experience backed up that belief. The mechanical technologies, which supplanted the horse, created an enormous trail of maintenance and repair, and of course manufacture. And there was never a problem of technical unemployment in the post-war period associated with that. Except for one small detail which tends to go overlooked in thinking about the effect of technology on labor, which is what exactly happened to the horses. They did not get counted in the unemployment statistics. And I would suggest that what we're seeing now is something similar for office workers. That is to say, a contraction in the willingness and ability of private businesses to hire because of a structural change in their need for that type of labor. And this did not happen before the crisis because businesses don't like to reorganize their activities if they're not under pressure to do so. But when the crisis comes and they purge their labor forces, then ex post, they consider what to do in hiring back. And I don't know what's happening in this country, but if you go into drugstores in the United States, pharmacies, you're now induced to do your own checkout. Right? Nobody does this anymore. Supermarkets, the same. I even have been in a restaurant, admittedly it was Disneyland, where you were induced to make your menu selections on a computer. That really was pushing it a bit far. But this is what's happening out there. And I don't, I mean, it looks to a Keynesian economist like the effect of a shortfall of demand, but it's impossible to distinguish that from a change in business strategy in the post-crisis environment, given that these technologies exist and that they continue to diffuse. So that's the third thing. And the fourth thing, which seems to me to be really evident, is the collapse of a trustworthy system of finance. The fact that we developed these very large, very costly banking institutions, just as we developed a very large and very costly military, which actually doesn't accomplish don't accomplish anything, don't serve any noticeable public purpose anymore, because they don't underwrite business loans, they're not making new loans, new C&I, commercial and industrial loans. Because the business models that they did develop, particularly certain major American commercial banks, which involved the use of statistical criteria for judging loans to households, have fallen apart, have been proven to be vulnerable to manipulation. And so they're not trustworthy anymore, and the only mortgages that get made are mortgages that are going to be bought by the U.S. government, by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are now, once again, national corporations. So, my view is those are issues which are going to have to be addressed before one can even begin to consider getting out in a significant way from the current mess. And I do not know how to address them, or in fact whether they can be addressed successfully. A first step, however, is identifying the questions that are in front of us. I want to say a few words in closing, this is taking a cue from my father, who taught me many years ago that when you're two-thirds of the way through, you should say, finally, because this wakes up your audience, it gives them hope. I want to say a few words about the difference in conditions in the U.S. and Europe, as I see them, and then about what I think to be the most pressing priorities. The U.S., curiously enough, for all of its reputation as being the free market end of the spectrum of so-called Anglo-Saxon liberalism, turns out, I think, to be revealed as the most self-stabilizing of the two continents because of the effective functioning of public institutions that were created by Roosevelt and by Lyndon Johnson, for the most part. That is to say, automatic fiscal stabilization, rapidly rising social insurance payments, Social Security, disability, food stamps, unemployment insurance, supplemented a little bit, but really the big thing was what was automatic, supplemented a little bit by the expansion program, by the so-called stimulus bill. And aided, no doubt, but I think a secondary role by the actions of the central bank, which were also what was called monetary policy à outrance in the old days. These programs that were created in the 1930s and the 1960s have turned out to be quite robust. And they have operated automatically and continue to function. They are under constant threat, and it may well be that cuts are coming, but they haven't happened yet, and the constant state of political gridlock in the United States works in favor of stability, which is not true in other places. There's another thing. On both continents, weak populations have been hurt. In the U.S., there's some buffers that stem, this is not a fact in our favor, but it stems from the fact that some of the population, construction workers, for example, largely come from elsewhere, from south of the border and went home. And there is also the fact that the debts whose failure underpinned the crisis in the U.S. are substantially private debts. They're mortgages. And there are two things that happen with a mortgage: that either gets paid or it defaults. Either way, the mortgage goes down over time. And if it defaults, it goes away entirely. You lose your house, and that's a tragedy. And millions of people have. But the debt goes away with the house in most states. And as a result, the burden of private debts in the United States actually has gone down in the 5 years since the crisis. Okay? Not true in Europe. In Europe, the debts in question are public debts, and they either have to be serviced or renegotiated. And the renegotiation is a bilateral, not a unilateral process, at least so far. So we have a situation in which it's easier under the American context for the debt crisis to be relieved a bit than it is in the European crisis. That's only one of the ways in which Europe, I think, has been less fortunate than the US. The basic problem, and this is true on the continent, is that weak institutions inspired by the generation of economists that inflicted their instruction on Professor Dembski and myself were proved wholly inadequate to deal with these kinds of events. The European Central Bank, okay, it had a dysfunctional charter, it said control prices only. I don't think that's the essential thing, but certainly didn't help. Much more important are the fiscal restrictions and the fact that those restrictions really did bite in the countries of the European periphery when their debt structures became unmanageable. The lack of a common system for resolving banks and the lack, or supporting them, and the lack of common social insurance at the continental scale, I think, play into the same problem. Incomes go down, and they are not replaced. And austerity simply makes the situation worse by compounding the losses, reducing GDP relative to debt, raising debt. And on top of that, you have the ideology of parts of the leadership of continental Europe, which is extraordinarily rigid, I think, by any standards in the world. What's the way forward? Well, as I said before, I'm not sure I have a way forward. And I'm not sure that searching for a cure is the right approach. When the patient is in the emergency room, the first thing you do is stabilize him or her. You try and prevent things from getting radically worse. Stop the bleeding. Medical metaphors are useful. The austerity metaphor is a bleeding metaphor. We shall cut, drain the poisons from the system, and the patient will recover on its own. This is what, of course, medieval doctors famously thought. Cut, 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 everything will be fine. The economists picked this up, this idea, through the physiocrats. François Quesnay was a physician to Louis XIV who discovered the circulation of the blood, the advantage of which was that you could cut anywhere on the body and get the blood, didn't matter. You didn't have to pick a particular finger to deal with a particular illness. And with that great insight, Quesnay went on to become the most celebrated economist of his time. That's not the way modern medicine works. Modern medicine, you don't bleed, you transfuse. And it would be an odd modern doctor who walked into an emergency room, into an intensive care unit, and said, gosh, look at all these patients with saline solution dripping into their arms. They're all very sick. Let's get rid of the saline solution because people out on the street don't have it. right? Which is another mentality of the present day economists. The deficits that we see everywhere are the saline solution stabilizing their economies. You try and remove them and the patient's not going to get better, it's going to get sicker. So a certain realism about the problem that you face and the dangers that you are courting by conducting yourself in a, say, on the basis of fallacious thinking, would be a very significant step. Ideas have to change first and foremost. I do think that if you want to restore a reasonable minimum of private profits in sectors that employ people doing useful things, you have to get them from somewhere. And I would propose getting them from the banks. Makes no sense in this situation to have institutions which in the US pay 10% of all wages and earn 40% of all profits and do nothing, except borrow from the central bank at zero and lend back to the treasury at 3%. The instinct of the Republican chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in 2009, Sheila Bair, which was to seize several of them and close them down, resolve them, was correct. And that should still be done because you can't support that level of resource drain if you don't have that many free resources. The conservation and management of energy obviously has to take a major priority, and not only for economic reasons, but obviously for climate reasons. And here we are faced with the rather mixed blessing and uncertain prospect of shale gas, which is a topic I could get into, but it would take a long time. And the truth is, nobody knows what its prospects are because the wells have not been in existence long enough for geologists to know their exact properties. Interesting situation. Let me just wrap up with the crucial questions. What do you do about all the people? I have a very simple view of this. One should have institutions that create employment to do things that need to be done. How difficult is this? If you have an aging population, you need people to care for it, for them. Right? Somebody has to pay them, and by and large, they're not going to be able to pay for them themselves. That's just plain common sense in my view. The people are there, the elderly are there, the young people are there. As Keynes said many years ago, there is work to do, there are people to do it. Why not bring them together? He was campaigning against Mr. Baldwin and asked, "Ah, no," Mr. Baldwin says, "it would be most unwise. Abra could rise, cadabra would fall. Unemployment is the lot of man, and each generation should take their fair share of it." Okay? It's a preposterous view now as it was then. Plain common sense says figure out what you need done and create the mechanisms to start getting it done. But I would go just one further step. And I realize I've talked much longer than I was allotted, but it's a complex topic. And that is to think carefully about the people who are not in the workforce, who are really a major piece of the picture. The elderly, the young, the disabled, and so forth. We have a situation where we probably need far fewer people going forward than to perform basic infrastructure functions in the society, the basic business of keeping business and government going, than we needed 10 years ago, 20 years ago. That's the nature of the technologies. Well, fine. We just adjust our ideas and provide people with incomes so that they actually don't have to be desperately looking for work that isn't there. And they then will provide a large element of stabilization. And I think this is extremely important for Europe, for continental Europe, for the Eurozone. because it is a requirement of the Eurozone that no major country, preferably no minor country either, be allowed to fail. And if you look at Greece, where I just was, 11 million people, the failure to stabilize the basic incomes of that society is visible on the streets any time of the day or night, people picking through the garbage, looking for something to eat. People sleeping on the sidewalks in large numbers. In some cases, quite elegant people, elderly, evictees from their apartments. This simply has to be stopped, and there's only one way to stop it, and that is to take a common responsibility to support the incomes and to do that reasonably quickly, because the ship otherwise is going down. Thank you very much.